7, Senator Carno.
I didn't realize it was coming that quick. The Senate caucus room is probably 45 degrees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate you taking this bill out of order since I'm supposed to be in another committee and help with something else down there. So I really appreciate you doing that. Senate Bill 167 grew out of the recognition that the current system was too adversarial and too haphazard in providing timely and reasonably priced and helpful evaluations for the family and the courts. It was the brainchild of Hugh McIsaac, who is on my left, and from the Oregon Family Institute, which is a nonprofit corporation established in 1989 to, among other activities, develop more effective family court services for small rural counties. Oregon Legal Services had identified this need as early as 1993 in testimony before the Oregon Legislature. And with that, I'm going to introduce Hugh McIsaac of the Oregon Family Institute and also Bill Howe from the Oregon Family Institute. And we meet every other month, is that correct? And I'm the representative from Eastern Oregon and travel over and meet with these folks and try to do the things that we can to resolve some of the problems for families in court. So thank you again for your courtesies, and I appreciate you hearing this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate it. Mr. McIsaac, is that correct?
Well, let me begin. The first and probably one of the more important features of this bill is it doesn't cost the state any money. The reason for the legislation, as Senator Carno pointed out, is the quality of evaluations in child custody and parenting time matters has been very uneven. Having panels and providing training and coordination to the local court will result in better evaluations and better methods of working with families. We've established effective panels in Tillamook and Clatsop courts, and this statute will encourage other courts to do the same. And we've been approached to provide training for courts in Eastern Oregon. Qualified evaluators are leaving the field because of the over-adversarial nature of the current process, and having a panel appointed by the court will help them address this issue. A wide range of interventions are needed for these high-conflict families. These families put children at risk, and the statute will encourage the development of these interventions. The statute is also consistent with the core values established by the Oregon Task Force on Family Law, of which both Mr. Howe and myself served. That's sort of a summary of the legislation and what it will do. And Bill, do you want to add to that?
Well, if that's what the chair wishes.
Well, yes, go ahead. Already generating questions here, but go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Howe. I'm a lawyer. I'm a partner with the firm of Gewurz Menasche, Larson & Howe in Portland. And I had the privilege for 4 years to chair the Oregon Task Force on Family Law, which was created by the legislature, and our job was to make the family law system less adversarial. We incorporated in statutes which the legislature passed, things like parenting plans, changing the language of visitation to parenting time, mediation in custody matters, and so forth. I support this bill. There's three reasons. First of all, we know in spades, the psychological and sociological literature is in, that parental conflict is bad for kids. Obviously, parental conflict exists in spades when people are going through divorce. And if the court can appoint custody evaluators, counselors, mediators that are helpful to reduce the conflict and at least have it reduced for when the divorce is finished, then we've done some good work. As I think there's going to be written testimony from Alice Phelan of the State Court Administrator's Office, it's true that to some extent under the old models where the parties propose different custody or parenting time evaluations, that can actually lead to conflict in evaluation. This statute allows different models to help parents transit that difficult period of separating their marriage, which, remember, divorce ends the marital relationship. It doesn't end the parenting relationship. You're still mom and dad. This statute not only allows the appointment of a panel, such has been so effective in Clatsop and Tillamook County, and the idea was pioneered by my friend Hugh McIsaac to the right and supported by Senator Clarno and the Oregon Family Institute, but it also allows for things that go by different names, such as special masters, parent coordinators. I understand that Judge Pamela Abernathy of Marion County was hoping to be here today. She's been one of the more creative innovators of different ways for the courts to intervene to help parents craft parenting plans and so forth. So this statute allows a large menu. No one, picking someone from parenting panel, special master, and so on, is perfect in every case, but it enlarges the menus for the courts. And I must say we, the citizens of the state, should be proud of the innovative and creative and energized way that the family court judges around the state, and I'm using family court not as a designated family court, but rather judges when they're sitting on family court matters, are approaching handling these difficult marital dissolution cases with an effort to be creative and help to reduce the conflict. And finally, one of the best parts of this litigation is to allow the judges to intervene early in cases and allow experts such as those that are on these panels to essentially be an advocate for the family and the children in a future-oriented way instead of stigmatizing in the way sometimes the custody evaluation has been done in the past. Thank you.
All right. We've had someone else join us. I don't know your name. I'm sorry.
Hello, I'm Andrea Anderle. I'm a private attorney. I also work at Pervert Menashe, and I've been on the Oregon Family Institute Board for 4 years. I have been a participant in the collaborative process with a client involving a young child, and I think the process is so important to have a panel of custody evaluators there available so the court can help determine what is in the best interest of these children. This process is a choice for the court to minimize conflict and help the children of this whole process. There are the unprotected parties in the dissolution proceeding have a chance to have a mediated ending, an evaluation that will look at their interest. And when the court can choose or help with a panel, that court has decided that panel of people are qualified and able to give the needed information and possibly minimize further advocacy and adversarial process and leave the children in a better position to go on and build into the rest of their lives with good relationships with everybody involved. So I really support this panel, and I wanted to be here for that reason.
Okay, I've got a couple of questions here. In Section 2 of the bill, it says at a minimum, a member of the panel must have a master's degree in psychology, social work, counseling, or other behavioral science. Were masters in divinity or masters in theology specifically omitted?
I don't think specifically omitted. I think this is language from the existing statute you have to have a training in, and I imagine it could be construed as a training in behavioral science if it covered the material that that was necessary to make those kinds of evaluations. But I think this comes from the existing statute.
Okay, but you have amendments, so.
I have the amendments.
Yeah.
Amendment.
Help me understand what's going on. We got a bill, and then we got a bunch of amendments. Are these amendments yours or something else?
These are the amendments by the Oregon Judicial Department, and maybe Alice can speak to those. Essentially, what they've recommended is adding some additional items to the bill, and left the determination of who would be qualified to the local courts. Subject to guidance from the State Family Law Advisory Committee. So it's a much broader kind of, it allows the courts a lot of discretion in setting up their panels. So go ahead, Al.
Okay. Why don't you speak to what it is?
Okay. Hello. For the record, I'm Alice Phelan, and I'm with the Oregon Judicial Department. And I'm here to speak in support of the bill and also perhaps to take us through the multicolored amendments that you have in front of you, hopefully, at this point.
Can you tell me how we have amendments already and how did this happen?
Well, actually, this has happened because this is a group of collaborators here at the table, and we were very pleased. Actually, when Senator Clano put forth the bill, I know my colleague Hugh McIsaac sent it around to a number of us, and we saw this as an excellent opportunity to not only put in the statute, hopefully with the, you know, with the legislative support, but also to do several things to that same statute. And that's what we've done with the amendments. We've worked with Senator Clano's office. We had several meetings in her office and worked through the issues so that we would have this proposed set of amendments. So that's why we're able to bring it to you today. And so I have some written testimony that's being passed out at this point and also a table that refers to a number of kinds of programs and services that the courts now have in place, are supposed to have in place, that my colleague Bill Howe referenced. The,
if I might for a minute, it's my understanding that these amendments are to make the options more flexible for the court in terms of the type of panel or individual that's appointed and to give the court the flexibility to craft what works best, where the original bill adopted the model from the Oregon Family Institute and what's been happening in Clatsop up in Tillamook County.
That's accurate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Chair members and members of the committee, the amendments, the multicolored amendments that you have in front of you, they would do several things. One, that they would, as I said, they would clean up a statute. This statute is referred to as the investigation and custody evaluation statute. As we started looking at that statute, and we knew that at least in the last 2 or 3 years, several between our judges and some legal practitioners, we had found that some judges were using Section 1 of the statute to order custody evaluations, where it others were only using that for investigations. Similarly, the same thing was in the case with Section 3 of the current current statute. So we saw this as an opportunity to clean that up, and that's what we've done in the first section of the section where we have changed Section 1, and we have now Section 1 and a new Section 2. What we have done there is what we have made it clear that Section 1 of the bill is for investigations, and Section 2 is for mental and physical evaluations and also for custody evaluations. Additionally, what we've done with the statute, with the amendments, is that we've identified that it would permit the courts to appoint an expert where the parties cannot agree. Currently, what the statute says is that the parties can't agree, that each party needs to present 3 names of experts along with the fees that they would be collecting. What happens actually in practice is that in many instances, the parties do not come forth with 3 names, particularly where there are no attorneys representing the parties. That can often be a great difficulty and seem insurmountable to people to go out and to contact the experts and find out, who do I even go to in my community? So what we were doing here was certainly making sure that we had a less cumbersome process, simplifying it. Well, also what we're doing in the amendments is making it clear that the courts can appoint a panel of non-adversarial custody evaluation panel, because it's certainly very important to the courts that we stay true to the original intent of the legislation. We're very supportive of the custody evaluation panels, as Hugh McIsaac and Bill Howe have described them. Additionally, we needed to, as our colleagues in the Division of Child Support were looking at the bill and any proposed amendments, they indicated a concern that they wanted to make sure, as the courts, if the courts did order the parties to participate in a non-adversarial panel or a parent referee was in place, a parent coordinator, they wanted to make sure that this did not prevent the ordering of the initiation or entry or the enforcement of the administrative or judicial orders for support. So we clarified that also in the amendments. And then lastly, what we've done in the amendments is, again, and I'm reiterating what I've said earlier, is that we have established that the court can appoint an individual panel or program to resolve parenting time disputes. This table that we've given you with some definitions on the back the large column to your right as you're looking at the paper would show what kinds of programs those might be. These are services that would be used for case management and oversight. Certainly, Bill Howe, as well as others, looked at this problem early when the Oregon Task Force on Family Law did its work starting in 1993 through 1997 and came forth with recommendations that we needed to, as much as possible, support the courts and our families in having more options to resolve their disputes. I think certainly what we've given you all additional information about high conflict families, and one of the things we'd like to note to you is that what we found in Oregon as well as in other places around the country is that about 7 to 12% of our families are what you would call high conflict families. These are families that are going to keep coming back and back to the courts. They'll start when the kids are young and they will litigate their way through the kids' adolescence period. You know, and I'm sure since I'm talking to people who've heard consistently from their constituents how expensive and how heartbreaking this is for families. And we, with these efforts that I applaud the Oregon Family Institute has brought forth, and parent coordinators and special masters and the guardian ad litem programs, we're looking to support different ways of helping those families, because otherwise we will continue to see those families using up 40% of the litigation that comes into family court. I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have, and thank you for considering it.
Well, Senator Burdick.
Have you done any kind of a fiscal, I know it's not a state fiscal impact, but a fiscal impact for the local courts that would have to switch to this, or is there even a fiscal associated with this?
There would be no fiscal impact. These are all to be provided and paid for by the participants themselves, so there's no cost to the courts. It's supported by Judge Brownhill and the Clatsop Court and Judge Hankey and the Tillamook Courts. And
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, every judge I know supports this. The reason why is that, I think this is as certain as we can be that this is going to cut down court appearances. The cost for the evaluators are paid for by the individuals. In a sense, what you're doing is you're hiring, making the individuals pay for kind of a private judge is, in effect, what it almost works out to be, whether that's the collaborative panel person who helps these people figure out a way to solve their own problems, or for the real slow learners, or the ones that need the remedial work, a special master that's basically their judge hanging over. So I think, if anything, it's going to save resources, which is not the reason to vote for it, but it's an unintended consequence.
Do you have any response to Senator Burdick?
Yes, I do. Chairman and Senator Burdick, actually, in this lengthy study, is some information that these often are less costly for the families involved. And we've not done a study in this state, but certainly we've been looking at this for the courts and for the families over the past year and a half. So that's, you know, other states have documented that using this is less costly. And then the other concern would be with the way, with this, the proposed amendments, that in some instances, some portion of the conciliation and mediation fee, which is collected by the courts and then transferred to the county for mediation services, could be used for some of these programs. So that it's not, it's clear that it's not, the state is not picking up, or the state or the counties are not picking up any new expense, but we're already collecting those fees. And then as these programs are set up, instead of sending a family to mediation, it may be more appropriate if they go to parent coordination, and the $300 to $400 would cost would be spent in parent coordination. So it'd be better use of funds.
Senator Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we're worried about the expense, why don't we just outlaw divorce?
Would you like to make that motion?
Did you hear what the chair said to that?
It's murdering. We'll look for gun stuff. Is there something that prohibits the system from doing this today on their own?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, there is conflict amongst the judges as to whether they can do these. Some judges are appointing people that they're calling special masters, parent coordinators now. Others feel they don't have the jurisdiction. Judge Brownhill in Clatsop County has, in effect, appointed a parenting panel.
Right.
Certain judges in Marion County think that they don't have jurisdiction to do that. So essentially what we're doing is we're providing the menu and this clear statutory authority.
Why don't we just write them a letter saying it's okay? It'd be a lot cheaper when you...
Well, the problem is that there's a case that the Court of Appeals decided called the Heinonen case.
I lose this one every time I go to that.
Families that can't afford to pay.
I keep asking.
Mr. Chair, the Clatsop and Tillamook panel, one of the criteria for to become a panelist, if I understand, and I should probably let you talk about this, is you have to agree to take a certain number of pro bono cases. Different counties have different ways of managing it. Some of them, the idea is to have groups of people or perhaps an agency be prepared to be a parent coordinator, and they have to agree, much like in the old days, court-appointed lawyers had to agree to take a certain number of cases at no fee and so forth. But that's a big problem. I mean, over 45% of the cases, family law cases, filed in Oregon a few years ago, neither side had a lawyer, good portion of those that couldn't afford it. And those children are just as needy. It's a terrible dilemma.
It's also, the fees are very moderate. It's based upon the federal poverty guidelines, $750 to $1,350. And as Alice pointed out, there is the possibility of courts using some of the funds that are dedicated for the mediation for this purpose. That's probably only in some circumstances a good idea. I think mediation is the first intervention. It helps the parties sort of resolve their own disputes. They know their kids much better than anybody else, and mediation allows them to do that. So this is a sort of secondary step, but there is the possibility to do that. So it's pro bono, the possibility of using the mediation funds, are the other sources to deal with that.
Chairman, Minnis, and members of the committee, while we don't have this in place here in Oregon, we've looked at that issue of what happens when some, you know, parents cannot pay, and there are certainly other states of looking at this. And in some states, and also perhaps very appropriate in our community, that the parent coordinator, the special a parent referee, it may be appropriate that that person would be a pastor or someone in the community who would do this as part of their other community work. And that was why one of the concerns that we didn't want to have in the statute the qualifications for the different service providers. We felt that it was better public policy to allow first the state's Family Law Advisory Committee to be looking at each one of these kinds of services and looking at what's happened in other states, and then perhaps to leave it so that you could rely on the person in the community who's the elder, who's respected, the pastor who would serve in one of these roles.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator, you're looking for questions.
Well, I am a little bit, Mr. Chair. This is a complex problem, which I'm not an expert on. So, but just what you're saying, and based on experience, recent experience, in fact, with some, in terms of resolving disputes with parenting time, I mean, how much responsibility do the courts have there? I mean, I've dealt with a situation just last Thursday in Marion County with someone I've been dealing with for a while, in which someone has... you have this dispute, but you have parenting time that's awarded to the non-custodial parent, and the court doesn't do anything about it. In other words, the other parent won't grant him his rights to have time. The court says just do it, and nothing happens. And the individual doesn't have the money to go further, and the court won't take any action to enforce that. I mean, I just kind of wonder how much of the dispute's because the court won't take enforcement actions over whatever has already been decided.
Mr. Chair,
you raised your finger, so good.
Metzger, I'm puzzled, and I'd like to hear more about that case. Let me tell you why. One of the bills that the task force proposed, which the legislature passed, and if I recall, Hugh, this one passed unanimously, was to create a quick, efficient parenting time enforcement thing that required no lawyers, that people can get the forms at the courthouse themselves. A hearing is required within 14 days. If someone intentionally denies parenting time, the court not only has jurisdiction to award the parenting time, award attorney's fees if they're lawyers, but cut child support, spousal support, and even award punishing damages. So I know, for example, Judge Eve Miller in Clackamas County is incredibly aggressive. There's a separate docket. There's a separate docket in Multnomah County. Mm-hmm. I know that Judge Pamela Abernathy in Marion County is vigorous on enforcing parenting time. At least that's what she has personally told me. So I'm very disappointed to hear that what you raised used to happen a lot. It's a big problem. There used to be no enforcement other than a contempt action, which essentially required lawyers, and it doesn't do any good. I mean, you don't get to see your child. So what if the other parent gets thrown in jail for a weekend and the courts weren't going to do it? They weren't going to throw mom or dad in jail. So I hope that's not happened. I'm troubled if it is, and if you'd like to write to me, I'd be personally happy to follow up.
I'll take care of that, Mr. Chair. I will take you up on that as well.
It sounds like it might be a training issue, too. How it's been in existence for what, 2 years?
4 years. It's possible, and in fact, Mr. Chair, you're right. The forms and so forth just got traction a couple of years ago, and in fairness to the courts, many are overworked, and some judges are much more aggressive on this than others, and some counties have been better than others.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? What I'd like to do, since you do have some amendments to this, is get an LC drafted and then bring it back and go over the bill again in terms of what the effects are. And by then, we should be able to get a hand in hand version of the bill.
There's no fault stuff.
Things have changed in the legislature. We don't use hand engrossed versions like we used to. When I say that, I'm like talking Greek to some people. So. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Anybody else out there wanting to testify on Senate Bill 167? If not, we will close the public hearing and get our LC amendments drafted. We'll open a public hearing then on Senate Bill 124.
Not the way it is.
Sammy Denting?
Yes, sir. Dentinger. Thank you.
Dentinger. Okay.
I have bad penmanship. Chairman, minutes, members of the committee, my name is Tammy Dentinger. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem with the law firm of Garrett Heeman, Robertson, Jennings, Construct, and Fufui. I practice exclusively in the area of family law. I'm also on the executive committee of the family law section of the Oregon State Bar, and I am their legislative liaison this session. And I am appearing in that capacity in support of Senate Bill 124, which is actually a bar bill. It's a fix of a current statute that codifies what we've already been doing, just gives us permission to do it. The statute allows for the courts to enter a stipulated judgment upon affidavit in default judgment cases. There's no specific statutory authority that allows us to enter a stipulated judgment by affidavit in stipulated cases. So what could happen without this change is that if the parties, both represented by lawyers or neither of them represented by lawyers, reach an agreement and finalize the stipulated judgment, they want to submit it to the judge with just an affidavit that outlines the prima facie issue.
Work session, Senate Bill 124. Thank you very much. I move Senate 124 to the floor, Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 124 to the floor of the Senate to do pass recommendation. Discussion.
I don't know if we want to cover the judge's backside like this. Let's make him squirm for a little while.
Well, you better be looking for some trauma counseling for Senator Courtney.
The carrier will be. Who wants to do that?
Not me.
Okay. Okay. Next up. Who's my next victim here? Let's see. Senate Bill 152.
The carrier scared me to death.
I know. I wanted to save your time. I didn't mean to scare you.
You scared her. What about me?
What about me? What about
her? That's me, baby. I'm still.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave. I'm here on the bequest of Senator Fisher. He apologizes. He is engaged in a committee of his own right now, and just wants to make it clear that he wishes he could be here for Senate Bill 152. Senate Bill 152 comes to us from a constituent of the senators from the Roseburg area, Frank Magallanes. And I have a prepared statement by Mr. Magallanes, which I will distribute right now.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Magallanes would also like to apologize that he wasn't able to make it up. I'm sure many of you are aware of the difficulties for many of rural Oregon citizens to make it up to Salem because of the drive on a weekday. If you'd like, I could read over the statement, just pointing out a few of the facts of the case. Essentially what happened was Mr. Magallanes' daughter was involved in a rape by a friend of her older son's. Now, this is Mr. Magallanes' daughter, and Mr. Magallanes' son had a visitor, and the visitor raped his daughter on a sleepover. If I could, I know that's a little cumbersome. Out of fear, Mr. Magallanes' daughter didn't tell about the rape, since it had happened twice, there was no lawsuit filed because the officer felt that it was consenting sex. Mr. Magallanes' family is afraid that somewhere down the line, this gentleman who currently doesn't want to have anything to do with his child, doesn't want to submit to a voluntary DNA test. They're afraid that somewhere down the line that he may want to press to have custody of the child or visitation rights. What Mr. Magallanes would like is that it be written in statute that, notwithstanding subsection 1 of the section, ORS 109-094, when a child is convicted of a rape of one of the parents by another parent, it is not in the best interest and the welfare of the child to be in custody of the parent who committed the rape or to have parenting time with the parent who committed the rape. A court may not award custody of the child parenting with this child to the parent who committed the rape. I was just in a conversation with Alice Fellin from the Judicial Department, and she brought it to my attention that we may need a definition of rape and statutory rape in this bill, and I don't believe Senator Fisher would be opposed to any amendments for definition.
Well, the bill doesn't require a conviction for rape.
No.
Is that intentional?
I believe it was intentional, and I believe the reason why was because there were no charges brought in this case. But from my point of view, I think a definition of rape might be advisable.
Okay. We have some other people that would like to testify in opposition.
Okay.
Tammy, get injured. You're back up again. I promise not to smack the gavel.
Just stop me if I go too long. Chair Minish, members of the committee, again, my name is Tammy Dettinger. I'm a lawyer in private practice here in Salem with the law firm of Garrett Heumann, Robertson, Jennings, Comstock, and Trefui. I'm also in the family law section of the Oregon State Bar, the executive committee, and I'm acting as their liaison today. I'm appearing on behalf of the family law section of the Oregon State Bar on Senate Bill 152. We have some concerns about the bill, although the bar and the family law lawyers in the state of Oregon are always primarily concerned with protecting children. The bill, we don't feel is necessary. There are other ways and other avenues already codified in which we accomplish the same goal. Under 107, there's a list of factors the court's required to consider in determining what's in the best interest of the child. on that list of factors, one of them is abuse of one parent by the other. So if one parent had been violent or if a child had been conceived as a result of a violent act, that was something the court would be required to consider and weigh along with all the other factors in determining what's in the best interest of the child. Another concern we have is that this bill does not require a conviction, so we will be opening the door to numerous litigated issues at a much lower standard, whereas in a criminal case you have beyond reasonable doubt. In a civil case, in a family law case, you're going to be talking about a preponderance of the evidence. So we're going to be litigating at the domestic relations trial court level whether or not a rape occurred, even though there may not have been a criminal conviction or a criminal, even a criminal arrest. So that's going to significantly increase litigation and in situations that may or may not merit the issue. Another concern is that, again, there's no definition of rape. There are situations where in a rape 3 situation you might have a 15-year-old mother, 19 or 20-year-old father, or vice versa, in which the situation might be very different from a rape 1 where it is a violent attack with a weapon. Those situations are very different and they shouldn't be treated the same as the bill would require them to do. Finally, the position of the bar is that the court has great discretion and the court is always required to make a determination in a custody and parenting time situation that's in the best interest of the child and to weigh all the factors that are involved in any particular family circumstance. We can't legislate every single circumstance that may arrive, and if we isolate one factor to the exclusion of all the other factors, it's going to tie the hands of the trial court judge in fashioning a remedy that's best for this particular child and this particular family. And again, under the existing statute, the court already has the authority and the discretion it needs to protect the children in this type of situation.
Senator Brady.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, was troubled by the lack of a conviction in this measure as a criterion. Would you feel more comfortable with having a standard like this if there were some conviction over perhaps a reduced, if something occurred and they were accused of rape but pleaded down or pleaded guilty to a lesser charge or were convicted of some charge in connection with the conception of this child, would that be something that would alleviate your concern?
Chair Menas, Senator Burdick, it would help, but I don't think it gets us quite there. Whenever we exclude one factor and ignore all the other factors that might be involved in a particular family, it's opening the door for an inequitable and unfair result versus if we leave the door open and the court can weigh all the factors in a particular family and a particular situation and fashion a remedy that's in the best interest of the child. I don't think we would have a problem if that was one of the factors the court could consider or should consider in determining what's in the best interest of the child, but I don't think it should be the only factor and that it should be an exclusive factor in making that determination.
Spoken like a good attorney. Senator Harper.
And could you just, you know, once again, I think I was raised on the moon. This is a no-brainer to me. Could you give me an example of where a child conceived under rape circumstances, it would be in their best interest to see their father?
In this, Chairman, Senator Harper, there could be a situation, and one of the ones that causes the committee the greatest concern is if the mother was 15-year-old and the father was 19-year-old, we'd technically be in a rape 3 situation. The mother
should be in jail for years.
Not necessarily in a rape 3. And when the mother might not be able to care for the child, it could be reversed. And the mother could be 20 years old, and the father could be a 15-year-old, and the situation could be reversed. There are just so many different circumstances that could happen in a family law case. Our feeling is that it's not a great idea to exclude one factor and not consider all the others.
Okay. Any other questions? I'm kind of on Senator Harper's side of your
house. Thank you.
So. Bill Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bill Howe. I'm a partner of the firm in Portland, law firm, Gewurztraminer, Ashey, Larson & Howe. We have 24 lawyers, and all we do is family law. I was the former chair of the Oregon Task Force on Family Law, and we wrote the statutes that created parenting time. And I have a fairly strong view on this, but let me first say that all of our heart would go out to someone who's the victim of a rape and their family. And so it's uncomfortable to come up here and by maybe suggest that somehow you're defending a rapist, and I would hope to suggest that's not the case. But maybe we're focusing this from a different direction. Shouldn't we be looking at it through the eyes of the children? If dad rapes mom, why is it that the child should never have a right to see dad? Why should the child be penalized? The statute says the court may not ever award custody or parenting time to the person who perpetrates the rape. I'm thinking Senator Harper asked an excellent question, but let's suppose we have a situation where there's a rape, and let's suppose 10 years later, dad rapes mom. Let's suppose 10 years later, mom turns into a drug addict, and dad has dealt with whatever his issues are and is a good guy. And the child's taken from mom, but dad can never have custody. Let's think about all the children who drove the Open Adoption Act, who longed to see their parents who might have even physically violated them, been physically violent to their parent. There's a somehow, almost perhaps on a cellular level, children need a connection with their parents. And so what we've done by this bill is saying in any case to the judge, we don't care what the special facts of this case are. We don't care if there are extenuating circumstances. We don't care if the people have changed over the last 2 or 5 or 10 years. We are not going to allow you to order parenting time or custody to someone who has done something awful. That something awful is rape, but you know, we're all sinners. We certainly wouldn't support a bill to say anybody who has ever punched their child should never have parenting time, even though everybody here would agree that's an awful thing to do. So the problem with the bill is that it takes one factor, as Tammy Dettinger said, and doesn't even use it as a lever to get what we all consider to be a good result, that is a further separation or punishment from the wrongdoer. But we're actually punishing more the child, the innocent party, than the wrongdoer, and we're making it permanent. We're cementing in the facts. I mean, no judge is going to award a rapist custody the week or month or year after the rape. But we're talking about a child who has an 18-year history, and we're disempowering the court to do anything, and that anything is contact with a child's parent. It's a bad idea. Thank you.
Can I let me ask a couple questions. How do you get past the fact that rape is a crime of violence primarily perpetrated against women? And how do you reconcile that issue and somehow say, let's look at it from the eyes of a child? Wouldn't a parent, a woman who conceives a child in rape, be a little fearful of having contact with a person who's committed such a violent offense against them?
Absolutely. And again, Senator Minnis, the uncomfortableness of opposing this bill is it sounds as though you're defending rapists, but couldn't the same thing be said as a woman or a man who is physically attacked, someone who threatened to kill mom or dad, even though didn't rape them? That's just as bad. You'd be careful. Now, keep in mind, in these cases, the court is not going to award custody or parenting time to somebody who's a recent rapist and violent person and all that stuff. And if they do, are going to take huge precautions. The problem with the bill is it doesn't say if you perpetrate a rape, you can't have custody or parenting time until a court makes a finding that you've managed your anger, you're able to deal with women, you have assumed responsibility, you've been convicted and served your sentence. It says if you're convicted of a rape, and it could be other things, for all time you're separated legally from your child. It's almost akin to a parental termination. I mean, my guess is that this is unconstitutional because you're essentially terminating somebody's parental rights without due process, without a hearing, and so forth. But that's a whole other issue.
Well, and you may have a point here. I mean, the bill doesn't say you have to have a conviction.
Right.
If the bill goes forward, I would suggest you have to have a conviction. You should have a criminal conviction. In that sense, I don't know whether or not that's a, it becomes a constitutional issue in terms of parenting or not.
Mr. Chair,
if you conceive a child in a violent rape, I don't know that the Constitution would recognize your being.
I mean, your point is absolutely right. It's an awful thing to rape. And it's a, and it, the issue is, you know, one of power and domination, and it's extraordinarily awful.
And actually, I'd like to get some additional testimony, because this is not something that I can experience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that men don't get raped, they do,
right.
But I couldn't conceive a child in that right. But it'd be interesting to hear from some women
mm-hmm.
who have in fact been raped
mm-hmm.
and to see whether or not they support your position or the position of the bill. So,
mm-hmm.
because to me, when I experience, and I do sexual assault investigations, when I talk to women who are the victims of sexual assault, it's extraordinarily devastating experience for them. Mm-hmm. And my sense is that you would probably be thrown out of the room, tarred and feathered, and probably whacked into tiny little pieces if
right.
in any way. So, Senator Harper.
Yes, I think you would. Let me, we think that there's a situation 5, 10, 15 years that everybody changes their lives around, and a judge agrees that you should see your son or you should see your children.
Mm-hmm.
What if the mother has an objection and it's forced on the mother over her objections? Is that equally plausible?
Yes, that could happen, because the job of the judge is to look at it not as an award to the mom or dad, but in terms of what's in the best interest of the child. Senator Baker, Mr. Chairman, a court is going to be mindful of this family's history, just as any. If there's alcohol or substance abuse or physical violence, any kind of psychopathology. And it's not as if you don't pass this law, therefore rapists are going to get custody and parenting time. That doesn't follow. But this law makes it impossible for the court ever in any circumstance to have a child have contact. And I guess my thought, Mr. Chairman, with your comment is, again, you're absolutely right. Victims of rape have very powerful feelings, and my guess is that most would be very much in favor of this legislation. I wonder, though, if it serves the interest of all of the people in this state that legislation be crafted out of the horrific individual experiences, but rather which has application to a wide number of people in very different situations. And I mean, we've all, including legislation that I've been involved in, had the misfortune of crafting things that have had unintended consequences. And I guess that's my only plea, is that we think about changed circumstances.
To look at your legal expertise, is there a, we're talking about the horrific rape situations. I'm curious to take this situation that was presented to us, but maybe in a different light. Under the law, this apparently was not a consensual act. And under the law, could two young people be engaged in sex that was consensual and still be legally raped?
Senator Metzger, Mr. Chair, yes, that's exactly what Tammy Dettinger was saying. If it's a statutory rape, that is, the parties both agree, they claim they're in love and all that, but one's under 16, then it's a rape. Now, I assume that's what the chair is thinking about in terms of defining rape, and my guess is the definition would be a definition that would sift out I'm making an assumption here, but sift out the statutory rape situation. But yeah, that was part of the technical problem with the bill. See, let me just throw this out. If it is so bad that dad should never see the child, we have in the statute now termination of parental rights proceedings. And you can just have the parental rights terminated, and then the dad has no more right to visit, or I should say have parenting time or custody, than I do or any of you. So what we're doing is we're saying, no, that's not good enough. We're going to preemptorily do it, but we're not even going to have a hearing over whether that's in the child's interest, as you're required to do in a parental termination case. I mean, I truly, and I say this with all due respect to the sponsor of the bill and so forth, I would be amazed if this thing was upheld as being constitutional, because you've taken such a huge chunk out of somebody's rights without the ability to be to have a hearing over it. But that's a different issue.
Thank you, Chair. What's the process in a situation where you have a child, where you have these two kids, and one will not submit to analysis for, I guess, to determine whether or not they're the putative father or not? And there's an allegation of rape, never been proved in court. How do you go to terminate parental rights in that circumstance?
Boy, Mr. Chair, you know, I should know that, but I wouldn't wish to give you misinformation. I know the court has the authority to order DNA testing, and whenever someone is on public assistance, the state will come in and require it. Here, I'm going to make an assumption now. I haven't read this testimony, but grandparents have stepped in and said, look, we don't want to hear from this guy. We'll take care of the child and our daughter. And so if you don't choose to follow up, if you don't petition the court to find out who the dad is, then, you know, it's not going to happen. Mom here could find out if she wanted to, go to court and file a proceeding for paternity, but she chose not to for whatever reason.
But I think you make a good argument when you say that in essence, termination of parental rights procedures available to someone. How you get there is another story. Does this child who's, or this person who's conceived a child in rape, then have to file some motion with court and go through that process and pay for the expenses of moving that through the process? That can be a fairly expensive burden, I think. So, Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm reading the language of the bill, counsel, and you got a lot of guts, counsel, I'll tell you that. When you look at just the language, and I also, this question is for Leonard and High Counsel Adele. Child support. Does this language on its face also automatically say it would not be possible for the court to order any kind of child support, any kind of financial reimbursement for the raising of this child, even though it was a very bad thing happened? I want you all to understand, I hate to be that mercenary, I hope you're going to call me that. What about the language of the bill as it's written, Leonard and High Counsel, in your opinion?
Senator Courtney, Mr. Chairman, I just learned about this bill today. I came in here and I wanted to comment on one issue.
Okay.
I want to answer your question, though. Instead of make the catalog of all of the other problems, some of which have come out in the questions, that is the parental termination, I think there's a big issue as to whether or not you can enforce support if you have taken away parenting time, because while we crafted statutes, which you folks passed, which says that parenting time and support are independent, and every judgment now has to have that language, Senator Courtney, you were on the committee that passed that. Nonetheless, if you eliminate all potential for custody and parenting time, I can guarantee you that you're going to have dads coming in saying, you've just deleted my obligation to pay support, because all of the support statutes are tied up, and you folks are aware of what the support enforcement's now doing and actually their own efforts to enforce parenting time, because they found that it's an efficient way to raise the collection rate. So this is one of the many potential problems.
Can I ask another question?
Yes, sir. I should know this, and I don't, counsel, but I'll just let you see ignorance for what it is. To the best of your knowledge, are there situations where a father does not have custody and doesn't really have visitation rights, but has been ordered to make some kind of payment for the raising of the child?
Senator Courtney, Mr. Chair, yes, that has happened frequently. There's many uninvolved dads who are ordered to pay support. The difference here is that those dads all have the potential under the statute to get custody. Their actions might be such that no judge in his or her right might ever do it. But what we will have accomplished here is saying, you have committed this act, and as part of the punishment for this act, it's sort of like, you know, a convicted felon can't vote. We're saying now that you've committed rape, so you can never have custody and so on. Then that class of persons can come in and say, now hold it. Essentially, my parental rights have been terminated. Now, if your parental rights are terminated, or if you they're terminated and there's adoption, you have no support obligation. So I can certainly see somebody coming and making that argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
Chairman, are you aware of circumstances where rapists are charged with child support?
Senator Burdick, Mr. Chair, I don't know of any personally, but I'm certain that there are, and I am just sure the support enforcement people could even generate a list of that. I mean, the fact that you're a father by rape does not absolve you of your child support obligations. Half the men in prison have child support obligations.
All right. Thank you. Senator Harper wants to move the bill, I think. We'll be a little bit more.
Thank you.
Deliberate. Thank you, sir. Anyone else wishing to testify? I think. Kathy Osborne, the author. You sent a note up here. Do you want to go over and tell the committee for the record what you said? Throw your 2 cents worth in here. You're a member of the bar, too, right? So you can. I love watching you guys fight. It's fun.
For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Kathy Osborne. I'm a senior attorney with the Juvenile Rights Project. Juvenile Rights Project isn't taking no position on this bill. My concern came when the discussion started talking about terminating, that a termination of parental rights action was available. 419B500 states the termination of parental rights. It does say that the rights of one parent may be terminated without affecting the rights of another parent, but in practicality, because the juvenile court is pretty overwhelmed by termination of parental rights, especially since the passage of ASFA, the Adoption and Safe Families Act, my guess is, and in practice it has been, that the courts are hesitant to terminate the rights of a parent when they are not going to be terminating the rights of both parents. They don't like making half orphans. And a lot of the reason is because the child then loses out on any Social Security, veterans benefits, or other rights that may be attached to the that parent being their legal parent.
Okay. Thank you. What appears to be a very simple matter is very complex. Let's see. Ronell, do you know of any rapists paying child support? I'll drag you into this, too.
Good afternoon. For the record, Ronell Schenkel with the Department of Justice Division of Child Support. Chairman, it's directly in response to your question. We would not be readily aware of our case. It would not be flagged, for instance, to say that this particular case involved a rape. However, there are rules and policies in place within the child support program that when a parent applies for services or their case is transferred over to us because the child is receiving assistance, we have some provisions built into place called good cause and claim of risk that allows the parent to indicate that the child was conceived through rape and to say they do not want child support services for that reason. That might mean that mom has custody of the children, comes into our program and says, I do not want services, including establishment of paternity, because of the history with this biological father, if you will, and we would not work the case. Now, that does not stop a self-alleged father, the man, from coming forward and saying, I want paternity established, but we also then would have procedures in place to evaluate whether or not we would proceed with that case or leave it to the court's discretion if it is indeed a case involving violence and rape.
Senator Burdick.
Chairman, to your knowledge, has a rapist in that situation ever come forward and tried to establish paternity and establish a relationship?
Chairman and Senator Burdick, anecdotally, from working on our child support program constituent desk, I can think of at least 2 times, and the procedure is greater than that. It also includes incest, but at least 2 times where we had a request from a self-alleged father to have us provide services, and we forwarded those cases on for determination by our program director, and I believe in both instances we chose not to provide the services but redirected them to court and to an attorney.
Thank you, Renaud. We'll close the public hearing. 52. Yeah, that was Senate Bill 154, public hearing. Sean's leaving.
For the record, my name's Sean Cleave. Again, I would like to apologize on behalf of Senator Fisher for not being able to make it here this afternoon. I have to my left Robert Sherman, who would like to read testimony.
Sure. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Robert Sherman. I live near Winston, Oregon, County of Douglas. I would hope to have written legislation that will allow me to see, even with supervision, my three minor daughters, ages 12, 9, and 6. I feel I have fallen through the cracks of the court system. 3 years ago, in a divorce civil hearing, Judge Ronald Poole ruled by a preponderance of evidence against me, giving me no parental time. My ex-wife accused me of sexual abuse. My now-deceased father apparently did sexually abuse two of my daughters. He was deceased at the time of disclosure, so I faced an uphill battle from the start of the hearing. Since my daughters had been abused before, it was very easy for my ex-wife, her attorney, the children's attorney, the district attorney, and Services to Children and Families, SCF, to pin the blame on me. It is worth noting that my children never accused me of these acts. I watched an interview tape made by SCF of my children. When asked if anyone had sexually abused them, anatomic dolls were used, they answered yes, their grandfather. When asked if anyone else had, they said no. My children's own attorney denied the court-appointed special advocate, CASA, volunteers permission to talk with my daughters, the very man who should have put the children's best interests first. This is what the CASA program is all about. Through this experience, I learned what SCF says carries a lot of weight in court. From day one and with no evidence whatsoever, SCF branded me a sex offender. When I first heard of these allegations, I tried to talk with SCF only to be told, quote, Mr. Sherman, we don't talk with perpetrators, only with victims. And the Douglas County District Attorney looked at this case very hard. They did not file criminal charges against me, and this is where I fell through that crack. I haven't been charged, let alone convicted of sexual abuse, yet I can't see my children. Something just doesn't seem right with that. And I'm current with child support, having made that payment every month, and I'm here today asking for your help. It's been almost 4 years since I have seen my children, and my goal is to have a normal parent-child relationship with them, even if it would be with supervised visitation. Thank you for your consideration in this matter.
All right, thank you, Mr. Sherman. Trying to determine the deleted language on the in the bill. Line 21 through 23 says the court may deny parenting time for the non-custodial parent under the subsection only if the court finds that parenting time would endanger the health and safety of the child. Is that the language that you feel compelled the court to do what they did, or I mean, why are we deleting the language? Do you know? Anybody know? Counsel?
Mr. Chair, this bill was filed before I came on as Senator Fisher's staff. Reading over this bill myself, of course, I have no legal training, but I would agree with you that some of the wording is a little confusing. And from my understanding, with my conversation with Mr. Sherman, there was some confusion in LC as to whether the language in this bill would do what Mr. Sherman had intended.
Chair Minnis, I think that the reason that was deleted is to require the court to conduct the same analysis that they must do in cases of abuse under 107-7184, that is to see if there is some less restrictive alternative other than denial, complete denial of parenting time.
Okay. Senator Courtney.
Sherman, so a court order was entered some 3 years ago regarding the custody and visitation of your children. Is that correct?
Senator Chair and Senator Courtney, yes, that's true.
And that was entered by Judge Ronald Poole, who said that you shall not have custody. The custody would go to your former wife, and that you did not have any rights for visitation. Is that correct?
Senator Chair, Senator Courtney, yes, that's true.
And you were ordered to pay child support. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you have been doing that?
Yes.
All right. Have you been back to court since then on this issue?
Chair, Senator Courtney, no, I have not.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not trying to trick you. I just curious to know, why have you not been back to court, given how you feel that you've been mistreated not only by the original order, but since this length of time has passed?
Chair, Senator Courtney, it's the cost. I've talked to a private attorney, two of them, and they said it would cost at least $10,000 to take this back to court, and my chances were probably slim at best.
Well, just one more question, because I'm trying to get a feel. You know, we're up here. Does the order itself leave open at all? I don't have a copy of Judge Poole's order. Does it leave open whether or not you should come back to court sometimes? That's the way they're written, you know. Anything, or is it just forever and a day? I mean, what is the tone of the order regarding the future opportunity for you to come back into court and talk about visitation, or is that all? How ironclad is the order that Judge Poole handed down?
Chair, Senator Courtney, I was just awarded no parental time, and it's a closed case. Judge Poole signed an order that said I have no parental time.
Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 154? All right. Thank you. We'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 154, and I think that concludes our agenda. We are adjourned.